astronomy and space with David Rennick.
SpaceX conducted a major test flight, successfully launching its massive Starship rocket and catching the booster back of the launch pad using mechanical arms. They called them the chopsticks. The test follows four previous Starship flights, which ended in failure, with the June test being the most successful up until now. Elon Musk sees this achievement as a major step toward making life what he calls multi-planetary, with plans to use Starship for Moon and Mars missions. David Rennicky, astronomer and all-round space guru and good guy, he joins us this morning. Hello, David.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again, Brent.
David, this was, I mean, the footage, I thought, yeah, this is all made up, but it wasn't made up. It was incredible. How will this successful test impact SpaceX's future Moon and Mars missions? And I suppose if you've read enough about it, how were they able to do this? I mean, how were they able to blast off, fly for minutes and minutes and minutes, and then all of a sudden it reverses, if you like, from whence it came back into the arms of Mother?
He's always been a maverick, this guy, and the reason he's good at what he does because he's been doing it and making mistakes, and he's learned from those. Look, his mantra has been, well, that's one way or not, won't work. He didn't care whether the thing blew up, he lost $1 million or $10 million worth of spacecraft. His team, he sat back with a smile on his face, and that's why I've always admired this fella, because he reminds me of people like Henry Ford, who turned around to the world one day and said, you're going to make 14 cars in a week. No one said, you believe me, how can you do that? What about other people in history? Look, when they opened up the shutters on India in 1920 in Queensland on Qantas, who'd want to go for an aeroplane flight at that cost? Now, here we've got a guy who's going to really change history for us. Look, what we saw there, and your really, really dramatic and romantic experience about or explanation on that, and that was quite accurate. What we're seeing here is about the same time we rolled out the Saturn V, this amazing machine that was going to take men to the moon in 9 or 10 years, and the brainchild of Wernher von Braun. Look, Elon Musk, love him or hate him, he's doing what he says he's going to do. And you mentioned multi-planetary species, well, that's his goal. He wants to do two things in history. He's not interested in space tourism anymore. He's more interested in taking a crew to the moon, and he's going to do that with NASA. He's going to be the one that puts the next crew on the moon there, but he also wants to take private people there. I don't know what I'm saying. I can't believe I'm saying this. He also wants to take people there who want to stay on the moon and live on the moon and work on the moon, but hang on, his main goal is Mars. He said he wants to live long enough to be able to do that. Do you know what? I reckon he will.
I saw, correct me if I'm wrong here, David, but I thought I saw footage of a rocket blasting off this week going to Jupiter, and it was going to be a 5-year trip to get to Jupiter. Is that right?
Yeah, the Europa mission has been put off about 25 years now. I'm glad this is finally launched. I've been watching this ever since I got into this business way, way back, and started talking about it. I remember writing a story about this about 25 years ago. Look, the Europa mission is interesting. Europa is a large moon of Jupiter. Why is it interesting? Because we can see geysers shooting out from the surface there. And when you look at the photographs coming back, Hubble photographs of Europa, it looks like a billiard ball with a lot of cracks on it, very fine little hairline cracks. Well, astronomers know now by probing that and looking at it with spacecraft that we find that there's a covering of ice over this moon, Europa. Now, this ice shelf, Brent, could be 20 kilometres thick. We're expecting it to be at least that. Now, underneath there is an ocean of something. We don't know. It's a liquid ocean, possibly water. We hope it's water. And down below that, there must be thermal vents. We know that, too, because these geysers are being pushed up through that ice shelf by some sort of a pressure. And why are we going there? Because it might be our only chance of finding life on another world. Because when you look at the geology, and the characteristics that Europa shows us, it's exactly what happened here on planet Earth as we evolved here with life forming in the oceans, in the thermal vents, in the rocks, and then clawed out onto the land there. So Europa is a 3-year mission. We should get the information back from it by probably around 2030.
Can I ask you about the SpaceX situation? How important is the reusability of the Starship booster for space exploration? Does it save him money?
Oh, very much so. I mean, this guy is making them out of stainless steel. He's getting huge rolls of stainless steel, and he's building them in a way that they've never been built before. The reason he's doing what he's doing is because he wants to launch at least once a day, or even once a week at the outside. And you can only do that with a rapid turnaround. The reason it caught it when it came back there is before they used to dump them in the ocean. You remember the boosters on the shuttle used to drop in the ocean?
Yeah.
Well, you have to go and fish them out. And then you have to clean them out and rein them out and then refill them. This guy doesn't have to do that. He's catching them when they come back here. And that was no mean feat. I tell you what, in the early days, he lost so many boosters and so many rockets. What you saw was the booster coming back. Now, he wants to perfect that so he can grab the rocket compartment itself. And the reason he's doing that is when you go to Mars, you can't land like, you know, we did with the shuttle there. There's no runway. He's got to come in bum first into the atmosphere of Mars. Now, there could be a complement of at least 100 people on board. And it may sound wacky or weird or really, you know, offbeat, but that's what he wants to do. His first crew is going to be 100 people who've nominated to go there and start a colony. I mean, this is what I read about in science fiction stories, and you did too, 20, 30 years ago. So when it comes in bum first, a lot of heat's generated from that, and there's resisting tiles on there like the shuttle had. But as it gets through the atmosphere, it's going to have to right itself, turn itself up, pointing up and the legs pointing down, because he wants to land on Mars on its legs. That's the only way you're going to be able to come back home. There's no launch pad there to do it. That's what he's doing. He's doing it successfully and very cheaply too, by the way. What he's doing, NASA would take a month to redo the shuttle to get it up and ready. He can get these ready in a couple of days.
It's said that it launched, the rocket's booster returned to the launch pad after 7 minutes, where it was caught by mechanical arms called chopsticks. The technology, is it difficult technology? Is it just you can't understand what's gone into being able to make this happen?
Man, I wish I could answer that. No one knows. He's the only one that knows. His engineers are the only one that knows. When he came up with this idea, everybody thought he was a nutcase. And look, even when he got started there 20-odd years ago, he approached all the major aerospace companies. So he got a good idea. I want to build rockets, and I want to do them cheaply, and I want them to land as they come down on their feet. Everyone thought he was a nut. So they said, look, you can have our rockets, but they charged him a massive amount of money for it. So he went away and chewed on that and thought, well, lucky you, I'm going to make them myself. And he did. And he started to form his own business, which we know now as SpaceX. He's got the money, he's got the technology, he's got the material, he's doing it faster, quicker, cheaper and better than anyone's ever done it before. And he wants to launch on a regular basis, and he will.
There's a story today, David, that Richard Branson is going to co-pilot the world's first crewed stratospheric balloon flight next year. He's going to take 8 passengers with him, 32 kilometres up. Now, how far is 32 kilometres from Earth's surface? How far up into the stratosphere is 32 kilometres?
Not very far. It's only about a third of the way to space.
Okay.
Space is determined by what's called the Kármán line, K-A-R-M-A-N. Now, that's been a new invention created by Richard Branson, because many years ago when he decided to build his Spaceship 1 and Spaceship 2, which is now abandoned, he's worried about killing somebody, or to kill anybody. But when he did that, he said to the FAA, look, I need to be able to advertise we're taking people into space. Where is space? And nobody knew, so they invented this Kármán line, 100 kilometres high. That's officially where space begins. So he's taking people up into the subspace area, not into space itself. But mind you, that's going to be viewed as out of this world. I do mean that, because when you look out from that gondola, and there are other people doing it too, space adventures are doing the same thing. This is going to be commonplace very soon. When you look out of that gondola, you'll be in an air-conditioned area, you'll have nice carpets on the floor, you'll have a bar, you'll be able to look out a panoramic window, and you'll see something only 550 or 60 people have ever seen, and that's the curvature of the Earth from a great height like that. The blue thin line, that purpley blue thin line that spins around the Earth, it's only very tiny, that holds our atmosphere. I'll tell you what, that would be a sight that's out of this world.
So how far up is the International Space Station in reference to from Earth's surface in kilometres?
Just under 400. The Hubble telescope's about 600K. That's why they can't reach it now. We needed the shuttle to get there, and it's just too far away. So the space station is truly in space, varies between 350 and 400K, Brett, and they can move it up and down if they want to, and they have to do that three or four times every year. They've got to move it out of the way of space debris that could collide with it.
Where's the mark? So you said the Kármán line, K-A-R-M-I-N, the Kármán line, is 100 kilometres from Earth's surface up. So that's where space starts, 100 kilometres up. That's the mark.
Yeah.
Where does gravity change where there's zero gravity? How far off Earth's surface is that?
That's a pretty good question. I'd say that a little bit further than that would be about there. The reason I know that is because when Ranson did send his Spaceship 1 and Spaceship 2 up there, they would have been about that height. Now, they were motionless in there, in that cabin. And I met Brian Binney. I shook his hand, had a drink with him in New York at the Hayden Planetarium after he took that first flight. And he told me that sometimes they get M&Ms. And they hold the M&Ms in front of them, and if they float, they know they're in space. True, that's true. That's an old trick the astronauts used to do. But they would have been about a bit over 100K, Richard. The people going up in the balloon there would feel a difference, but it wouldn't be a dramatic difference. You'd probably feel a little bit lighter, but it wouldn't be the full effect.
I'll bet you'd love to be in that balloon, mate.
Oh, you betcha. You would too.
I don't know. Okay.
An OB.
Well, let me ask you this. I've never been in a balloon before, but I have had many people that I've spoken to been in these, you know, balloon flights over the vineyards and stuff like that. And it's all supposedly very, very calm because you're travelling with the wind and you're travelling in the direction that the wind takes the balloon and all those sort of things. Would this be the case with the Richard Branson balloon?
No, complete silence. You wouldn't hear a thing. All you'd hear would be the air conditioning inside there. Outside, you'd have the coldness of space. If he went up higher, he would be. Where he's going now, the temperature where he's going now would be about the height that an overseas aircraft would fly to England, to you know, America or whatever. I think it's a bit over 30,000, 40,000 feet. And, you know, you are exposed to more radiation up there, so you've got to sign waivers. You've got to sign waivers. You've got to make sure you're healthy. But they do say that you are in a thinner part of the atmosphere, and what you'd probably get would be two or three extra doses of what you get a chest X-ray from. Pilots have got to be checked every year for that, too. They do fly constantly overseas, and they fly at high altitude. So where they would be in the balloon, there wouldn't be any danger to anybody, but no, I think what he's doing is a prelude to moving it higher and actually going into space itself. And that Kármán line is the measuring. That's the official borderline between Earth and space.
I just was looking at March 15, 2012. Is it Baumgartner? He completed the first of two test jumps where we remember we saw him jump with a parachute in space to come back to Earth, and he was successful. He was 21,818 metres up. I was just trying to work out how many kilometres that was from the Earth, but it certainly wasn't 32 kilometres, that's for sure.
Have you seen the vision of that?
I have, yes. Yeah.
He sat there and he contemplated, will I do this? Am I going to do this or not? Whole world was watching him, and he jumped. And I remember his comments were, as he said, as I jumped, he said, I was amazed to see the gondola shoot up in the sky. He said it was shot up like a rocket. Then he realized it wasn't it. It was him that was falling very fast. He actually almost killed himself. He almost died. he went into a tumble there, and he couldn't get out of it. He was in this eternal spin, and he was about to black out. Now, the guy who was looking after him on the control panel there, I forget his name, in the early 60s, he did the same thing, and he experienced what Baumgartner, so he's telling him, you know, put your arms out, put your legs out, and try and stabilize yourself. Well, Baumgartner did that, and he did luckily, straighten his trajectory up, but that was a hairy jump.
Well, he was
the Red Bull, I think.
He was 22 kilometres above Earth's surface, he was.
That's
22 kilometres,
you know,
when he jumped,
yeah?
When he jumped off that off that little platform. So the balloon is going to be 32 kilometres up, so it'll be even, yeah. It'll be even higher. All right,
even higher.
I better let you go. It's always a delight and when we chat with you, David, so thank you for making a time available to us on this Saturday morning. Mate.
My pleasure, Brent. Thank you.
We will talk again soon. That's David Reneke, astronomer and as I say, all things space guru. It is 25 to 11. 1312 69 is our telephone number. If you'd like to talk to us. I'm just thinking, I always learn something when I talk to David Reneke. Today, what did I learn? I learned that the Karmin line, the K-A-R-M-I-N line, if we take nothing else away from that discussion, we learned the Karmin line. It was called the Karmin line. It's called the Karmin line because of Richard Branson, because he wanted to know when he took people into space, what was the line where it stops being Earth and becomes space? So they decided it was 100 kilometres above Earth's surface. 100 kilometres above Earth's surface, it's called the Karmin line. Isn't that incredible? And that's where it becomes space.